Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
This morning, for our opening words, I want to share a Zen Buddhist story that I've heard told over and over, and perhaps some of you have heard it as well. It gets told in different ways, but the gist of the story goes something like this. Two monks were traveling together on a long journey. One monk was older, the other younger. They come to a river that's rushing quickly by, and there on the bank, looking bewildered as to how she might cross, is a young woman. She asks the monks if they can help her to get to the other side of this rushing river. The monks look at one another, silently remembering together the vow that they had taken to never touch a woman. But then, still in the silence, with not a single word, the old monk picks up the young woman, carries her across the river on his back. When he makes his way through the currents to the dry side over there, he places her down gently. The older monk rejoins the younger one, who is speechless. An hour goes by, not a word is spoken. Another hour, and another, and then finally, the younger monk can't help it anymore, and he bursts out. "We are not supposed to touch a woman. How could you carry her on your back?" And the older monk looks at him and says, "Brother, I set her down on the other side of the river. Why then are you still carrying her?" Sometimes we get stuck on things. We think things should be one way without question, without reflection. Sometimes we worry about taking chances. We think that the risk might cause us to lose our very identity, our very selves. But often that stuckness and that worry just holds us back, keeps us mired, maybe safe in some sense, but unmoving. Aware that nothing stays the same, that our community shifts and grows, that we shift and grow, that the world is ripe for change, and so are we gather together this morning. This morning, I would like to invite you into some extended time for meditation. So please settle into your seat, find the most comfortable position, let yourself relax. Breathe in deeply and try to focus on that breath as it moves in and out of your body. Breathe slowly and deeply. As you keep breathing, I invite you to imagine all that you carry. The woes and fears, the griefs and struggles, to imagine them as stones you are holding. Responsibility, stress, decisions yet to be made. Whatever you carry that feels heavy, whatever makes your jaw clench and your shoulders creep up, feel their weight. And then breathe in deeply. And picture one of those weights, those stones in your hand. As you breathe out, imagine it just rolling right out of your palm. Release it onto the ground. And as we sit together in the quiet with each breath in and out, release another burden, release another stone. Keep taking deep breaths in Imagine those stones you let roll, forming a road, a way forward. Not every weight we carry in life can simply be let go, but often they can be let go for a while. Always, we can reflect on them again and rethink the ways they weight us down. May we each find ways to let go, at least some of the time. May we find ways to cross the river, leaving behind what needs to be left behind. So may it be. Earlier this month, my oldest son and I went to see a local theater production of 1776. Our neighbors, like literally our next door neighbors, were in the show, and Ethan's theater teacher and a friend of mine. And this show, if you've not seen it, centers around the negotiations and arguments and compromises made to get the 13 original colonies to declare independence from Britain. Among those compromises, for example, is the retention of slavery, demanded by the slaveholding colonies and acquiesced to by the abolitionist founding fathers for the sake of pushing independence forward. We enjoyed it, and it made me think about a lot of things that are different from the way they were, and some things that remain alarmingly the same. In the show, of course, every character is a white male. And just this morning on NPR, Tammy Duckworth was on, and she was saying that there are only 22 women in the Senate, as compared to 51% of the American population being female identified. Still to this day, compromises are made in governing that compromise our moral wholeness. There's a lot that I wish were different that isn't. And it made me think, too, about the fact that our nation's primary set of agreements about how we're going to live and work and govern and be together is quite old. A couple of centuries is nothing to scoff at. It has seen additions and adjustments, but it is also viewed with a degree of authority and permanence that sometimes feels suspect. There is a core that remains worthy of our uplifting, right? That core about freedom and equality and treating each other well, about the pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness enshrined in that declaration. There are worthy goals that were set for us centuries ago. And it was just after the Constitution had been drafted and implemented that Benjamin Franklin wrote in a letter that line, part of which is commonly invoked. He wrote, "Our new Constitution is now established and has an appearance that promises permanency. But in this world, nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes." And that glib line that so many of us repeat, that second half, it didn't actually begin with Franklin. It began with Christopher Bullock, who wrote something similar in 1716, and Daniel Defoe, who adapted it in 1726, before Franklin got his hands into the mix in 1789. Each of these incarnations speaks to the certainty of death and taxes. And while I realize the intent of these quotes is to snidely speak about the painful and fear-inducing prospect of paying taxes by comparing it to the most extreme of inevitabilities, there's another avenue that that quote opens if we look at it humorlessly and with utter sincerity, right? So if we take that quote completely at face value, we can say that indeed, death is certain. We will all die. We may not know exactly what that means or what it's going to look like as it unfolds, but it's true. The cycles of our life lead inevitably in that direction. For some of us, it will happen younger than we hope. For others, older than we wish. But for certain, at least right now, in the course of human science and history, all of us will die. This particular version of our lives will end, and nothingness or something else will take hold. And yet, while ultimately death is indeed certain, its inevitability need not always be a cause for despair or a cause for hopelessness. Because although there are many things over which we have no power, we cannot control if we become ill, we cannot control if our genetics destine us to certain challenges, we can make, as individuals and cultures, choices that might, hopefully, give us a better shot. Just yesterday, in response to supposed attacks using chemical weapons, the United States and others together bombed alleged chemical weapons factories in Syria. And I've said to you all before, and I'll say it again this morning, that at the end of the day, we live in a world where perfect peace for everyone, where everyone is committed to health and wholeness, that doesn't exist in our world right now. And so I can't actually consider myself an 100% complete pacifist. And I'll say, too, that often these things happen and I don't feel that I know enough to say what is right or wrong in the long run. And I will confess that yesterday I spent my entire day at t-ball and soccer and running around outside, so I did not sit down and read all the analyses. So this morning I'm not going to offer a judgment on the choice that our government made. I might do it later this week, but not this morning. But I am going to say this. We don't live in a world in which people privilege health or wholeness, not other nations and not our own. We live in a world of warmongering and violence and fear, and these are choices that do not do anything to retain life and forestall death. When we bomb other nations, we are participating in choices that take lives, that make the inevitable arrive sooner than is necessary for others, and that threaten to hasten it for us as well. I will say this morning that I long for a time when collectively the world agrees that all people deserve a chance at the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness that our founding fathers lifted up. I long for a world in which the certainty of death is met, yes, with some equanimity, but not with the need to make it come more swiftly to others. This morning, as we consider together what is permanent and what can be set down, I am mindful of the human cost of violence and hatred around this world. And so as we think about what is certain, what is inevitable, I think about that second part, that taxes are certain. And yes, okay, right now you kind of have to pay your taxes, right? I like taxes, actually. I'm a big fan. Not necessarily the actual check I have to write, but the services they provide to me, to others, to society at large. I'd be in favor of higher taxes, even more services. So don't misunderstand. I think taxes are worthwhile. I'm not about to go on a diatribe against taxes. But are they certain, like really certain, in some fundamental sense, in the way that death is certain? And remember, we're looking at that quote humorlessly, right? We're taking it at face value. Death is a natural part of living, a change in being. Taxes are a social construct made necessary by the way we choose to govern and the way we choose to live, right? Yes, it's the way we've done things for a very long time, and it may in fact be the best way, but they aren't inevitable in the way of natural cycles. They are a construction, like borders and nations and race and money. Those things have a sense of certainty because we assign them a sense of certainty. There is nothing beyond death that is actually that certain. But we become comfortable, assured, stagnant in our belief in the permanency of these things. Taxes, the two-party system, comfort, freedom, a particular way of governing or a particular set of rules. Any of these things, none of them are really that certain. They exist because we believe they are important, and we come, after many years, to treat them as fixed and static things. But when we actually pause, when we step back from our attachment to these things that we create, we find that so many of them are not fixed at all. But we come to idolize, enshrine, mummify things that don't need to be held so tightly. And indeed, we might be better served by openly examining them once in a while. That brief Zen story I shared earlier about the monks that crossed the river embodies this Buddhist understanding of impermanence, an understanding of the fundamental truth that life comes into being, ages, decays, and ends, that nothing lasts forever. Buddhism, like every other tradition, has its set of beliefs and practices that make up its core. Among them is the belief in the Four Noble Truths. These are core beliefs that Buddhism teaches. One, that all life is suffering, that this is so because humans cling to impermanent things, believing in their permanence, but that the end of that suffering is possible, and that end can be achieved through the Eightfold Path, which is a way of living in the world that commits a person to cultivating compassion and peace, harmony and gentleness, cultivating focus and awareness and a commitment to moral and ethical behavior in the world. Through the practice of these behaviors, one can achieve enlightenment, and enlightenment leads to a cessation of suffering, a move beyond the world that is bound up with impermanent things. The Buddha was born, Siddhartha Gautama, over 2,500 years ago. I'm sure some of you know his story. He was a prince, wealthy and privileged, and at his family's bidding, he lived in an enclosed area, never going beyond the walls of his happy existence. But one day he decides to leave the safety of his palace and to see what the world is like. And he journeys forth and he sees for the first time in his young life an old man, a sick man, and a dead body. And his life is turned upside down. He's so disturbed by these encounters that he completely changes his life. At first, he becomes a monk, and he finds in that no way forward. And then he becomes an ascetic, giving away all things, all commitment to material objects, living a life of abject poverty. But in this, too, he finds no way forward. After his seeking and trying different things, he develops the middle way, a life somewhere between luxury and utter poverty, a life focused on letting go of extremes, of detaching from the impermanent trappings of life. And he sits himself down under the Bodhi tree, and he meditates, and he reflects on life and his experiences until he achieves enlightenment. And clearly, I'm giving you like the teeny tiniest description of his life story. In this enlightenment, he finds that no longer is he suffering from the pain caused by attachment to the transient things of this world, like health and wealth and others. Buddhism teaches through the life of the Buddha, through the Four Noble Truths and the path to enlightenment, and through that Zen story, a letting go. It teaches a releasing of our own belief in the permanent, a letting go of our self-delusion that we have ultimate control, and that the things we believe must always continue, must indeed be the same forever. It teaches a kind of nimbleness of being that neither denies nor idolizes the trappings of human society and the human constructs around which so many of us build our lives. Now, I'm not a Buddhist, and I am far from enlightened, but I find a truth, as we often do when, per our six sources, we look at other traditions of truth in the world. And the truth that I find in this Buddhist understanding of suffering and attachment is that we can let go of some things. Now, just as I can't quite bring myself to preach total and utter pacifism, I'm not sure I can preach complete non-attachment. But I do think that we have a bad habit of making things harder on ourselves because we come to see some things as fixed when they truly aren't. Or we come to see things as ours when they aren't. We have a reading in our hymnal about children, and it talks about how they don't belong to us, but are beings unto themselves that we steward and shepherd. This reading cautions against seeing your children as a reflection of you or an extension of you. Too often we attach to things that we don't own, right? That don't belong to us. And we try to hold tight when it's time to let go. Too often we're the young monk worrying rather than the older monk moving forward with hope and purpose. Too often in life we think we are in a position of ownership rather than of stewardship. And this is no less true in the life of a congregation. We come to imagine ourselves one way, both the congregation we participate in and ourselves in it. We're a small congregation, one community might say. If we grow, we won't be us anymore. We're a congregation of wealthy corporate folks, another might say. We don't do direct action. We give money and that's it. Or I make meals for someone might say. I can't teach religious education classes. Or I organize the festival, another might say, and no one can do it the way I can. There are so many things that a congregation and its congregants come to believe, so many ways the stories say things are done, that they need to be, that they can't possibly be any other way or be done by anyone else. Just like the young monk thinks to himself that the vow about not touching women must be followed, nothing else can be done. But the older monk has some sense of being able to adapt, knowing that in that moment, something can shift. It doesn't mean the vow is broken. He sets her down and goes right back to following his vow, one presumes. And it doesn't mean that the vow was wrong in the first place. It just means that sometimes life calls for something different. Sometimes life asks us to take a little bit of a risk, to adapt, maybe for just a little while, maybe forever. Nothing is certain in the life of a congregation, not its size, not its existence, not the work it will do, none of it, really. We just have the way things have been done. And the way things have been done is, in many places, wonderful. For example, when I think about here, and I think about the amazing programs that have been built here, the social justice that has been done, the caring that is accomplished on a daily basis, the warm welcoming that people of all kinds receive here in this place. When I think about the legacy of preaching and worship that I have stepped into, the history of religious education, there's so much strength and beauty and so much of value that hundreds of people over decades have dreamed and worked to build and then shepherded through changes in our society, in our religion, and in our world. And I think about how adaptable they had to be, as indeed the world has changed. Unitarians and Universalists joined together. America moved through the 20th century, bringing wars and struggles and decades of abundance. And I think about how now, in this moment, nothing is certain but death. We don't know where our country is headed. We don't know where the American religious landscape is headed. We don't know perfectly the future of this place. But over decades, this place and all the institutions around us have changed in order to adapt. We know this. Amendments and alterations have occurred, not for the purpose of denigrating what came before, but for building on it, moving forward. Because things are shifting and changing, and we need to find the ways to honor and uplift what went before, to bring the core of that, the compassion and the kindness and the justice and the love and the working for a better world, we need to bring that core forward using all the tools at our disposal, being willing to take risks to get across the river. There's another expression about how nothing is constant except change, right? Change isn't easy, but without it, we remain stuck on that one side of that swiftly moving river, preventing others from crossing it as well. We believe, as Unitarian Universalists, in equality and opportunity and the chance for all to use their gifts and live their lives in fullness and wholeness. Sometimes radical change is called for, sometimes just minor change. As we steward this beloved congregation, we have to find the ways to set down the rocks we are carrying and move forward across that rushing river so we can get to the other side. Some years ago, I was wandering through an arts and crafts fair in a seaside town on the eastern shore of the United States, and my mother and I wove our way through the booths, taking in the pottery and the baskets and the jewelry and the long sculptures. And we happened upon this unassuming booth filled with loom-woven goods, and a blanket caught my eye, just large enough for one person to seek warmth beneath it. The blanket was a mass of colors woven tightly. At each short end, A half foot of yarn strands hung loose in a woolly fringe. The colors evoked a riverbed, muted blues and greens dancing over pebble browns and slate river stone grays. Here and there, strands of purple glanced through like light dancing on water. The blanket looks like one phrase in the symphony of moving water, pulled from a river that is at once unchanging and ever-changing, at once always new and yet eternal. I fell instantly in love with this blanket and the way it captured that essence of life, that things feel so often static and yet in truth are so very fluid, that change is inevitable even though it often comes slowly. My mother gifted me with this blanket, and it has stayed with me over the years, through school, the birth of my children, moves, griefs, losses, joys, celebrations. It has kept me warm, been at times merely an aesthetic addition to a room, been buried beneath Legos and toys and the stuff of life. It has assisted in worship. It has been a touchstone, not unlike the rivers I have grown up alongside, and it has held for me their power when I have lived far from their running constancy. Our lives bring so many changes. Our congregational lives bring so many changes. But they are somehow like the waters as well, different from moment to moment, and yet something there is of a core, a truth, a heart, a certainty. On any given day, a different group of individuals constitutes the community. Members come and go, ministers come and go, rituals, events, traditions, mission statements, folkways, they all come and go. But something there is that stays. A congregation can persist through many changes as long as it stays aware of its essence and also its transience. There's a beauty that holds at the center through all the changes. A beauty that is that core of compassion and love and care, a heart that beats through any change. And that heart can be seen by anyone who walks through these doors, can be honored by all of us who love this community and lifted up as the thing that is permanent-ish through all the transience. All these changes, these comings and goings, they leave their trace. They make their marks, just like the water that flows leaves marks on the rocks below. The changing life of a congregation builds a story, a history, a symphony. With each person who comes in and out, with each alteration in style and each new annual tradition, the music builds and plays, the strands are woven in and anew. Things are not completely lost. They move. They rearrange. Pebbles shuffle down the river. New ones arrive, borne by the water and human hands. Colors are added. Yarn strands might slip out and others be woven in, but the blanket doesn't disappear. Depending on where you look on this blanket that I love, it may be the watery blues or the stony grays or the vibrating purples that come to the front. And over the years, the fringe has frayed in certain places, pulling at strands, and there's the occasional bump in the weaving if you look extra close. I haven't had to mend it yet, but in truth, it feels like with each change in my own life, the blanket somehow changes, becoming different, holding echoes of pain and loss, containing celebration and joy, reflecting life. The life of the individual that mirrors the life of a congregation. It's a stubborn reminder that nothing stays the same forever. May we remember that impermanence affords us a chance to find freedom and liberation, to make a way ever more consistent with our values. Together, may we honor the past and embrace the future, whatever changes may come. So may it be.